Before we begin, don't forget that if you want to hear this episode ad-free, then sign up to our members channel. Just search for What's the Story Crime in Apple Podcasts or follow the link in our show notes. Members will get exclusive access to all episodes of Smoking Gun, completely ad-free, before anyone else.
The florist hand-picked the most vibrant rose stems from the buckets at the back of her shop, pulling out each in turn to sit alongside blooms of complementary shades and sizes. This particular bouquet was turning out to be a beauty. Bold fuchsia sat alongside pastel pinks, popping against the green of the leaves and foliage. The perfect gift to brighten up the cold and darker days of January. She often thought about the recipients of her flowers and smiled to know what a positive impact she had on her customers' days. Birthdays, anniversaries, weddings, all of life's celebrations. And there were her flowers, making those moments extra special. With a final flourish, she took the bouquet out to the shop front and handed it over to the man, waiting to take it away. She waved them goodbye before moving straight onto her next order. It was turning out to be a busy day. The florist had no way of knowing, or couldn't possibly even conceive, that her joyful bunch of roses would not only be used to conceal a gun, but that they'd also end up being the smoking gun, which defined the trial of the decade. My name is Sarah Henderson. I've always been fascinated by the world of forensic science, the amazing ways in which crimes can be solved, and the clues which can be found almost anywhere.
And my name is Tracy Alexander from Forensic Response UK. I've spent years inside these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice. And my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and the wrongly accused go free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun, Series 4, The Bunch of Flowers.
The marriage hadn't been working for a while. For longer than a while, actually. And over the years, Lita's resolve to fix it had ebbed away. At the beginning, she'd held out such hope for them as an item, even though the odds were against them. They were a biracial couple, sure, and they had very different backgrounds. But what did that mean when you were in love? In fact, the union of Lita McClinton and James Vincent Sullivan, from the outside at least, looked perfect. Two beautiful people in their prime, residing in beautiful houses, wearing beautiful clothes, and living the good life. Lita's influential family had bestowed upon her grace and poise, important qualities for a high society mover and shaker. And James, a Boston-born businessman made good, after inheriting millions from an uncle. Lita's family was sceptical about James as a future son-in-law. They felt he was inauthentic and dishonest, an opinion which seemed to gain weight when he admitted to his bride-to-be that he'd actually been married before, telling her the night before their wedding. As if that wasn't enough, his admission contained more: the fact that his previous marriage had produced children. Four of them, in fact. It would be enough to make anyone question if going ahead with a wedding was the right thing to do. But Lita was nothing if not determined. So, in a stunning winter ceremony, they became husband and wife in December 1976, much to the disappointment of some within the congregation. The newlyweds didn't exactly get a warm welcome when they moved to their new home in Macon in the Deep South, where the fact that they were a biracial couple was met with overt racist disdain. Garbage was dumped on their lawn. Bananas and watermelons delivered to their door. Comments made wherever they went. The message was clear. Lita and James were not welcome here. So the decision was made to move. James had big plans of making a name for himself, and the couple agreed that a change of scenery could put them back on a more positive footing. They landed on Florida, and after moving to Palm Beach in 1983, Lita hoped that the couple's fortunes, metaphorically at least, were on the up. Florida was much more accepting of the couple, but life remained far from perfect. Lita's skin colour still prevented certain doors from opening. And James, who could at times be entitled and arrogant, began to blame his wife for him not reaching the upper echelons of Floridian society. James's love became increasingly mercurial. One day he'd be civil, kind almost. Other days, he barely acknowledged her existence. And then there were the affairs. Lita had lost count of how many at this point. The betrayal that she felt was only made worse by the lies that went alongside them. Lita told friends of her devastation when she found long blonde hairs in her bed and women's underwear which didn't belong to her. Money was also a source of deep resentment from James, particularly as he'd started to imply that Lita was holding him back in business. Lita determined to convince her husband that she loved him deeply for who he was, not for his bank balance, even suggested she sign a post-nuptial agreement if that would alleviate any worries he had. "What about if I sign something that says I'll only receive a $2,500 monthly alimony payment if our marriage fails," she said. But it made no difference. If anything, James seemed to respect her even less after it was signed.
Lita couldn't do it anymore. She was 34 and had so many years in front of her. At least she thought as much. Christmas had been and gone, and they were officially in the first month of a new year, 1984. It was time for a fresh start. It was time to start divorce proceedings. In the fall of 1985, Lita packed up her belongings from the couple's Palm Beach oceanfront mansion and fled to their $430,000 Atlanta townhouse to be closer to her beloved family and friends. She needed all the support she could get to help her through what would become a very turbulent divorce. James was furious that Lita was attempting to claim more than the postnup she had signed. And he had every right to be worried, because it appeared that Lita had a significant chance of being awarded half her soon-to-be ex-husband's estate. The final judgment loomed over him, with the final settlement hearing scheduled for January 16, 1987, 3 new years after divorce proceedings started. But what this new year would have in store, few people could have foretold. On the morning of the settlement hearing, Lita was nervous. She hadn't slept well and was standing in front of the mirror trying to smooth out the bags beneath her eyes. She heard a knock at the door. For a second, she thought about leaving it unanswered. She was in her bathrobe after all, but then stood resignedly and made her way to the front of the house. A tall, white man stood on her doorstep. He was holding a box of roses, the bloom spilling out over the edges of the container. They were magnificent. But who sent them? Someone wishing her luck on this stressful day, she thought. How kind. That was before she saw the 9mm in the man's hand. Before he lifted it and began to fire.
Bob Christensen was at the window in his study that morning. He was looking through some papers, and he'd raised his glance in time to see the flower delivery man walk past, heading towards his neighbour Lita's house. He'd trained his gaze back to his desk when he heard the gunshots. And, as he'd tell news crews later that day, he immediately thought, Sullivan has ordered his wife to be killed. Bob ran from his house towards Lita, who he could see crumpled on her doorstep, with blood creeping ominously from beneath her body. It looked like she'd been shot in the head. But Bob also thought he could see the rise and fall of Lita's chest. She was still breathing. Someone else had called the cops, and from somewhere far away, sirens started to blare, getting louder by the minute. Lita was rushed to the hospital, where doctors frantically, manically worked to save her life. But she was losing too much blood. The injuries to her head were too great. And within hours, she was officially pronounced dead. Her friends and family were notified, and the news spread like wildfire around the community. Those who knew Lita, or even those who didn't, but knew of the acrimonious divorce, were all convinced James Vincent Sullivan was responsible for his wife's death. But word was that Sullivan was in Palm Springs, hundreds of miles away, a cast-iron alibi.
This was the crime of the decade, and as such, the speculation of public interest was fever pitch. Police were under the microscope of local, if not national, scrutiny, and they too couldn't escape the glaring motive of Lita's husband, James. James was, of course, questioned. Even he understood that with their marital problems, any murder of his wife would cause plenty to ask questions. But James had an answer for everything. He claimed Lita had been taking drugs and that the murder was most likely a drug deal gone wrong. That was his story, and he was sticking to it. But it was an assertion anyone who knew Lita immediately dismissed as preposterous. But the police had to go where the evidence was taking them, thus beginning one of the most fascinating cases in Atlanta criminal history. First things first, forensics. Scenes of crime officers found a palm print and a single thumbprint on the flower box, though nothing came up as a match when they ran the print through the Georgia or national databases. And other than gunshot residue on Lisa, and presumably on the murderer at large, there was nothing else to examine forensically. No hair, no sweat, just the palm and thumbprint. However, while things felt frustrating on the forensic side, eyewitnesses were forthcoming. In fact, various people came forward with the description of three men seen racing from the crime scene, and composite sketches were made, though none of these composites matched Sullivan. However, the same three men seen and described had also been seen at the local flower shop, situated less than a mile from Lita's house. These men had been seen buying a box of pink roses from this very shop the morning of the murder. And the breadcrumbs went further. The same men seen by witnesses fleeing the crime scene, the same men seen buying pink roses, had furthermore been seen checking into a local hotel, and investigators were quick to search the room the three men were thought to have stayed in. They signed in, of course, but it was determined that the names in the guestbook were false. However, something definitive was the itemised call log made from the room during the men's stay, and the phone calls on the list which were made directly to James Sullivan's house. And it wasn't the only incriminating call James Sullivan received. Having subpoenaed James's own phone records, police noted a call which James had received around 40 minutes after Lita had been shot. It was made from a rest stop just outside of Atlanta, a signal perhaps that the deed had been done and that James's soon-to-be ex-wife was dead. James Sullivan denied taking such a call. Probably a wrong number, he claimed. While their belief in his guilt gained weight with every day, police knew there was nothing they could do without proof. The three men who'd been seen near the scene were never found. The leads had run thin. So detectives reasoned that if retrospective evidence wasn't forthcoming, perhaps James would still incriminate himself given enough time. And what better way than when he thought no one was listening? It was decided that the next course of action was to covertly wiretap Mr. Sullivan's residence.
The phone calls we make every day, the appointments we book, the long catch-ups with friends. If our unguarded conversations were monitored long enough, we'd all probably say something we wouldn't want overheard. So in February 1987, when Sullivan called a friend and talk turned to Lita's murder, officers listened intently, hoping he'd drop his guard and say something to establish his guilt. And they weren't disappointed. A little way into the conversation, James referenced the gun Lita was shot with as being a 9mm. However, the calibre of the gun was information which had not been released to the public. Unless he was involved, there is no way James could have known this. Police, though delighted their suspicions were confirmed, knew it would not be enough to bring him to trial. His comment was not sufficient evidence to directly link him to Lita's murder. So while the scandal and gossip around him continued to bubble quietly beneath the surface, while looks would linger a little longer than usual, or voices around him might drop to a whisper, James Sullivan was free to live his life as a free man. A man no longer under the shadow of a looming divorce and a potentially drastic reduction in his financial circumstances. He had a new girlfriend. He was free to eat at Palm Beach's finest restaurants and drink in the best bars. He was even appointed to a prestigious seat on Palm Beach's Landmark Preservation Committee. And when James's glamorous new girlfriend, Suki, agreed to marry him, well, that was the icing on the cake. 8 months after Lita's murder, they tied the knot in a ceremony fully endorsed and attended by the socialites who had looked down on Lita. Money talks, and nothing could hold James back now. Or so he thought.
3 years later, in 1990, James was pulled over for speeding. The officer who leaned in through the driver's side window immediately noted that his license was out of date and took his details. His wife sat by his side in the passenger seat, not saying a word. Driving a little too fast and having an expired license, while not the worst offences, did mean that James was expected to attend traffic court. However, when Suki arrived at court on the appointed day and testified that the police officer had made a mistake, that she had been the driver that day rather than her husband, it didn't take long for the couple's deceptive scheme to unravel. Under questioning, Suki crumbled and admitted she wanted to protect her husband from any more public scrutiny. Predictably, the judge did not respond well, and rather than a fine or a slap on the wrist, Sullivan was sentenced to 1 year of house arrest for perjury, which soon afterwards became 2.5 years after agents found unregistered guns at his residence. As the old saying goes, bad things come in threes. So perhaps James wasn't surprised when Suki reached her limits and filed for divorce. The scenes in the courtroom, maybe echoing what might have played out between him and his first wife, got very messy very quickly. And Suki had a trump card up her sleeve. She dramatically claimed that James had confessed to her that he arranged Lita's murder. Bingo! Could Suki's testimony move Lita's case forward and finally bring Sullivan to justice? Detectives believed so, and the needle moved further still when Sullivan was extradited from Florida to Atlanta to await trial. The prosecution and defense teams, both high-powered and high-profile, got ready to go to battle. Suki was the crown jewel for the prosecution, but the defense did all they could to discredit her. A thrice-divorced woman surely couldn't be seen as reliable, they suggested. And again, where was the proof, the direct link between James and the person who shot Lita? After just a few weeks, the judge had no choice but to dismiss the case due to lack of evidence. And James Sullivan once again was, for all intents and purposes, declared innocent. However, even Palm Beach's glitterati couldn't turn a blind eye any longer. James was resolutely persona non grata, dismissed from the Preservation Society and shunned from the community as a whole, forcing him to move away to a quieter and more remote ranch house in Boynton Beach in search of a little more anonymity. But unfortunately for James, the dead have a nasty habit of not staying quiet.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Philip Anthony Harwood, 47, was a trucker whose work had taken him all over America. He kept his business private and his life modest. Like everyone, he had skeletons in his closet. Best not to draw attention to them. So he was incredibly surprised when police turned up on his doorstep in January 1998 to question him about Lita Sullivan's murder. How on earth had this happened? He thought to himself. And he didn't have to wait long to be enlightened. An ex-girlfriend of Philip's had been watching a TV special about Lita's murder. And when a picture of suspect number one, James Sullivan, flashed on the screen, she had a sudden recollection. She remembered this man as having paid her ex-boyfriend some money, $25,000 in fact. She didn't know the details, but she knew it was something to do with the man's ex-wife, and she told the call handler of the hotline number as such, which had set this whole thing in motion. Harwood didn't know how to deny it. He hadn't prepared for this eventuality. And under questioning, he admitted that he'd met Sullivan in November 1986 when he had moved the millionaire's belongings from Macon to Palm Beach. It didn't take Sullivan long to ask Harwood to carry out a very dark task for him. For the right sum of money, of course. Harwood was arrested on murder charges and ultimately sentenced to 20 years in prison. He had narrowly avoided the death penalty by agreeing to a plea deal of a lesser sentence in exchange for testifying for the prosecution against Sullivan. And moreover, police now had the direct link they'd been searching for. So in May 1998, 13 years after Lita had been found dead, a warrant was issued for Sullivan's arrest. Not that Sullivan would come quietly. Even as detectives swarmed his Boynton Beach ranch, Sullivan was on the run, having boarded a plane to Costa Rica. Over the years that followed, he was sighted in Switzerland, Ireland, the Cayman Islands, Guatemala, Venezuela, and Panama. Until finally, in June 2002, he was located and arrested at a resort community just outside of Bangkok, where he lived with his new wife. After 19 months imprisonment in Thailand, he was extradited back to Atlanta and indicted on new charges, including murder and aggravated assault. It was the news Lita's family had waited almost two decades for, and her mother released a public statement at the time of the extradition. I am just pleased and happy. I did feel that as long as we pursued him, there was always hope. We never gave up hope of finding him, she said. And due to Harwood's testimony and the weight it lent to the prosecution, the prospects for Sullivan were grave indeed. If he was found guilty of capital murder, Sullivan now faced the very real possibility of receiving the death penalty.
Sullivan's trial began in February 2006, 19 years after Leta's murder. The jury, 13 women and 3 men, hear Harwood's testimony, the linchpin of the prosecution case. But his testimony was not at all straightforward. The tale he imparted to the jury was riddled with seeming inconsistencies, including recanting being the one to pull the trigger, which meant the defence were easily able to portray him as an unreliable witness. Harwood claimed that the real shooter was a bartender named John, whom he had enlisted to help with the hit, and he insisted that during the shooting he had been sitting in the car near Leta's house. However, this new narrative was soon discredited by the witness who remembered seeing the men buying the beautiful, long-stemmed pink roses. Looking Harwood straight in the eye, he said, "That's the man I saw." It was as damning as it gets. But that was Harwood's culpability. The man everyone wanted behind bars was Sullivan. So the jury listened intently as Harwood told the jury that he'd met with Sullivan in a restaurant to arrange the final details of the deal. He'd be paid half up front and half when the job was done. And that he was instructed to ring Sullivan after that fateful flower delivery to tell him that the hit had been a success. As the defence and prosecution rested their cases, it all hung in the balance. For the investigators who'd spent years overseeing and progressing the case, for the prosecution team battling it out in the courtroom, and for Leta's family, the tension was almost too much to bear. Would Sullivan, the man they all believed was responsible for Leta's murder, finally be brought to justice? The jury then began deliberations on March 10th, 2006. It took them less than 5 hours to find Sullivan guilty of murder, and he was later sentenced to life in prison without parole. The presiding judge said that the entire case was a very long, difficult, horrible story. And the bunch of beautiful pink roses, while they had not delivered joy on January 16, 1987, nearly 20 years later, they had helped to deliver justice. Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Sarah Henderson.
And by me, Tracy Alexander. The series is supported by Forensic Response UK. Our work promotes the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas, and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future.
If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review and help to spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to listen to all episodes right now, you can find them completely ad-free on our subscription channel, What's the Story Crime. On there, you'll also get exclusive access to a whole bunch of bonus interviews led by me, where I speak to some of the most experienced and skilled forensic scientists from around the world and find out more about what they do. Those interviews are only available on What's the Story Crime.
There's also a whole range of brilliant true crime content all made by the same team. You can check out The Missing, with more than 60 episodes all about long-term missing people, which invites you to try and help solve the case. You'll also find exclusive series like Jigsaw, true crime investigations like 900 Degrees, and incredible stories told over several parts. Whatever you're into, if you enjoy listening to Smoking Gun, we're sure you'll find your next must-listen podcast on What's the Story Crime. Signing up is really easy. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, just search for What's the Story Crime, subscribe, and you'll get all your favourite shows ad-free. For listeners on Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or any other platform, all you need to do is click the link in our show notes or visit www.whatsthestorysounds.com/crime. Your subscription helps to ensure we can keep making more of the content you love. And it costs just $3.99 per month.